All right, if you've listened this far, you know the deal. The book that came out of this podcast is called How the Internet Happened, From Netscape to the iPhone by me, available wherever fine books are sold. Also, the podcast I do these days is called The Tech Meme Ride Home. Search any podcast app for Ride Home, and you should find The Tech Meme Ride Home, which is all the day's tech news every weekday in just 15 minutes. If you like this show, you'll love that one.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to the Internet History Podcast. I'm your host, Brian McCullough. This is Chapter 2, Supplemental Episode 2, an interview with Compaq co-founder and CEO Rod Canyon. If you've watched Mad Men recently, then you're familiar with the fact that AMC is heavily advertising a new scripted series called Halt and Catch Fire. Set in the early 1980s, it tells a fictionalized account of a rogue group of programmers and entrepreneurs who launch a new computer company by reverse engineering and cloning an IBM PC. When I heard about this show, I was excited because last year I read Rod Canyon's book, Open, How Compaq Ended IBM's PC Domination and Helped Invent Modern Computing. So I was excited. I thought, now even television is getting on board with the technology history thing. Well, I watched the first episode, which is streaming online, and let's just say it's very loosely inspired by actual events. But that doesn't change the fact that there really is an interesting true-to-life story about the birth of the clone PC industry that they're drawing on here, and the whole Silicon Prairie scene in the 1980s that spawned Tandy, Compaq, and Dell, among others, is really fascinating to me. And so, in honor of the show premiering this weekend, I thought I'd bring you that story. Rod's book is actually one of the best first-hand accounts of the high-wire act that is a technology startup that I've ever read. And I know that this story is a bit outside of our purview in terms of internet history, but the story of Compaq's founding, how it took on Big Blue and actually wrestled control of the PC paradigm away from IBM, is so compelling that I think it'll be instructive in relation to the other startup stories we've been examining. And if you listen to Chapter 2, Episode 1, you'll know that we did talk a lot about the state of the PC industry before the birth of the internet era, so this should fit in quite nicely. And so, in honor of the new show Halt and Catch Fire, an interview with Rod Canyon of Compaq Computers. Rod Canyon, thank you for coming on the Internet History Podcast.
Brian, I'm very happy to be here.
Rod, you're a native Texan, that's correct?
Yes, I am. I am a native Texan, actually a native Houstonian.
And you went to the University of Houston?
I did. I went there for 6 years, got my bachelor's and master's in electrical engineering.
Did you head right to Texas Instruments after college?
I went to TI right after I got my master's degree. I sure did.
So in the early 80s, you and Jim Harris and Bill Murto are all executives at Texas Instruments, and you guys get a wild hair to start your own company. Can you tell us about that?
Well, first, using the term executive is a stretch. We were managers. We weren't high enough in the organization to even be called an executive. But that was a good thing, it turned out, because we were close to the good and the bad that goes on inside a big company. But there were a number of factors that led us to decide to start a company. Part of it was, to be sure, the excitement around the whole microprocessor industry that was beginning to grow up around companies like Apple and even Atari and the game companies, because you could see where it was headed. It was going to be a really big deal, a game changer. And then, like I think happens a lot of times, we were inside a big company and we're beginning to get a little frustrated at the leadership that was not going in the direction that we believe strongly we needed to go, and that it wasn't going to allow us to go that direction. So we talked about it and talked about it. And finally, one day, we just started.
And you just started without necessarily knowing what the product would be, or you knew it would be in computers, but you didn't start out with the idea of doing a portable computer.
No, we didn't. And in fact, that was one of the farthest things from my mind, because one thing TI did a very good job of was teaching their employees about intellectual property that belonged to TI. And so we knew that if we came up with going to be somehow in competition with TI, that would be a problem for us. So very hard to try to come up with a idea that was not going to be competitive. So I think that after, you know, they found out what we were doing, they would be okay with it.
So you guys are obviously very careful about, some of you make sure to quit before the company starts, but you're very sure to keep that Chinese wall between what you're doing and what you had been doing at TI.
Yes, we were very careful about that. We worked on things outside of our hours at TI. We worked on things that we didn't think TI would view as competitive. We had learned from our experience there, and we're, you know, not wanting to get into any trouble as we started. So yeah, we did a very thorough job of that.
So can you recollect how the idea to do your own computer, to do a fully 100% compatible PC came about?
I remember it very well. It was one of those things that I literally felt a chill down my spine. The idea came together because it was really a combination of things that made it work. The idea for a portable computer, there were a number of those already in the market. You know, the only reason we were actually even looking into that area was because once we quit, the first idea we had, the venture capitalists decided not to fund it, which they had told us they might not fund it. And so we decided we would start looking more broadly. And the way we did that was we sort of divided the market areas up, and each of us would go off and do research and think about potential product ideas. And then we would gather and discuss them, see if anything looked promising that we could begin to focus on. So I believe it was the morning of January the 8th, 1982, that I was working at home alone in my breakfast room, and I was going over the idea for a portable computer. How could we make one that was differentiated enough to make it worthwhile? And, you know, there were some obvious things. There were improvements in styling, for one. It was so obvious when you looked at the Osborne Portable, which was very successful at the time. It was not suitable for a business environment. So styling was one. We decided that ruggedness, it didn't appear to us that any of the existing worlds had really been designed to be moved around. So designing it for ruggedness, and we understood how to do those kinds of things to a product. The end of the day, though, there was this one big hang-up. As much as I loved microprocessors and computers and would love to have built one, the idea that not being able to get software developed for it was a killer. What happened in the morning, for the first time ever, killer apps that were required for success had hit the market. So the first one was VisiCalc, the first spreadsheet, truly a breakthrough, and I think in many ways the real enabler of the whole PC market. At least it got it going. But the VisiCalc spreadsheet program had to be adapted to each computer. Every computer ran different software. And there were literally somewhere close to 300 different computer companies making new computers at the time. There would never be VisiCalc for our portable. And then one day, that morning, the idea hit me that what if we could make our computer run software that already was out there, that is, run the software for the product that was getting the most software and always getting the first software when a new one came out, and that was the IBM PC. Because IBM had done something they had never done before, which was bring a computer to market that wasn't just totally protected from a copying standpoint. We didn't want to copy their computer. We wanted to have access to the software that was written for their computer by other people. And so we did some work on it very quickly, put together a four-page business plan, and presented it to some venture capitalists, the same ones that we had originally talked to, Seven Rosen.
Well, and let
now,
me
the fly in the ointment. What?
Let me interrupt you there. It's important for
sure.
People that don't remember. So the IBM PC, IBM was late to the game. So they rush out their IBM PC and they use off the shelf materials, but they're also wildly successful. So when you're talking about you want to create a computer that all the software will run on, it's because the IBM had become so popular that most developers are developing their software and their apps for the IBM PC.
I would say every software company that existed at the time was, because IBM was just, they were the leader by far. They had come into the market with a little bit of an advanced product, but not anything really that far ahead of anybody else. But with the brand and the time, it was just right, and every software company jumped on the IBM PC and adapted their product to run on it. So that it was the obvious one from that standpoint. But the real, you know, the totally unexpected twist was we couldn't have done it if IBM hadn't done exactly what they did, because nobody else, Apple certainly wouldn't have stood for us to make a product that ran their software. They had enough protection on it to prevent that, as did all the others. IBM, the best one to pick, also happened to be the only one that wasn't protected, and it was because of this sort of strange thing. They didn't believe much in the market. They just rushed a one-year project to get to market, and therefore they had used off-the-shelf parts and really had very little protection. They did have the BIOS copyrighted, so you had to be very careful copying that. And they had written, they modified greatly Microsoft's MS-DOS, the operating system, to run on their PC, and it was copyrighted, so you couldn't copy it. But both of those could be reverse engineered, and that's the thing that our experience knew. We knew there was a way to do it. We believed we could do it legally. We didn't just assume things. We hired the best intellectual property attorney we could find and use their strict guidance to help us do the reverse engineering very carefully.
So just to back up for a second, this becomes your idea to do to create a PC that will be 100% compatible with the existing IBM standard so that it'll run all the software. And this is the idea now that you go back to the venture capitalists like John Doerr and you say, hey, this is what we want to do. And that's what finally gets the company funded, correct?
That's exactly right. We actually went to Seven Rosen. LJ Seven was based in Dallas. They liked the idea. They sent us out to talk to Perkins, and at the time, John Doerr was a young venture capitalist, and he and a couple of his partners put us through the ringer that day. I remember that very vividly as well. They did a good job of asking good questions, and at the end of the day, they agreed to fund us. So very quickly, literally just about a month from the day the idea was conceived, we had at least a handshake on funding, and we're getting ready to start the company.
So the key is that you have to reverse engineer the BIOS, because that's, as you said, that's the one part that is protected. And what is the process for that? You have to make sure that you do it so that you don't infringe on anything. I think that it wasn't the BIOS, wasn't it already, it was in the manual, correct?
They had, in order to allow software developers to develop applications that used subroutines that were in ROM in the BIOS, they had published the exact code of the BIOS in ROM. But it was also copyrighted. There were actually a few copies that went in and just simply copied out of the manual, and they ended up getting sued and shut down. But we knew, fortunately, not to do that. And what our lawyers told us was that not only can you not use it, anybody that's even looked at it, glanced at it, could taint the whole project. So we organized, even though we had very few people, we had two software people. One guy read the code and actually generated a functional specification. So it's like, you know, reading hieroglyphics, figuring out what it does, and then writing the specification for what it does. Then once he's got that specification completed, sort of hands it through a doorway or a window to another person who's never seen IBM's code, and he takes that spec and starts from scratch and writes our own code to be able to do the exact same function.
And to some extent, you have to do that with DOS as well, correct?
Well, DOS was different, even though it was a similar kind of situation. The interesting thing is Microsoft actually supplied a version of MS-DOS, and they were selling it to many, many companies at the time, to adapt for these companies to adapt to their computer. Now, the thing, it seems strange today with everything running all the same software, but back in those days, there was no thought given to making the exact same version of MS-DOS run on every machine. So they were all really totally incompatible, even though they all ran MS-DOS. That was sort of the, it was referred to as the standard, but it was a standard of name only almost. So our idea was, well, actually, incorrectly, when we came up with the business plan, we believed we could buy a version of MS-DOS from Microsoft that was compatible with IBM. We weren't able to verify that before we went and presented our plan and got funding. But that was what we believed and certainly hoped for. It was not until after we had gotten our initial funding, started the company, and went to Microsoft, found out that actually, no, they can't, because they don't even have access to it. IBM had gone off and modified it, even though some Microsoft people had worked with IBM. It was totally owned by IBM, and they did not have access to it. So what we got from Microsoft was, somebody else got a completely incompatible version that had, inside somewhere it was similar, but from the outside it was totally different. So that led to another type of reverse engineering where, even harder than the first one, we had to simply try out each software package, each and every third-party software package. We had to run on our computer using MS-DOS and find out what didn't work, and then go into MS-DOS and change it to make it work. And there were literally hundreds of places where we had to go in and make changes to MS-DOS. But in the end, you know, after almost a year of just beating away at it, finally hiring a lot more people than we started out with and that we thought we would need, we were able to make enough changes to make our computer running our own reverse-engineered BIOS and our own very carefully modified version of MS-DOS. We were able to run all of the IBM PC software.
And that's, that computer is the Compaq Portable, which comes out in November of 82, I believe. That's really an amazing achievement for a small team, a small startup.
Yes, it was. You know, part of that was we just had some incredible people. You know, when we started the company, the three of us from TI, we all knew each other very well because we had worked together and you know, in sort of close quarters on starting up businesses inside TI. And the sort of engineers we hired were engineers we had worked with for 5 or 10 years. We knew exactly what they were capable of. They were, you know, some of the best we've ever seen. So when the going got tough, we had a very, very good core of people and began to hire top-notch people to go with them. And so it was a matter of finding people, a clean understanding of what we couldn't do legally, and then just a bullheaded commitment to making all the software run. And very interestingly, we were shocked when we found out none of our competitors had done it to the same degree. You know, we could speculate on why they had stopped short of complete compatibility. It was hard, and it took a long time, and it was a natural rush to get to market. People wanted to be first. There was only one thing for us. We didn't have a product if we couldn't run the IBM PC software. And if you didn't run all of it, how would anybody be confident enough to buy your computer if they didn't know they were going to always be able to run new software? And so we took it very, very seriously, I guess, probably more seriously than any of our competitors.
And you're wildly successful because of that. Compaq, I don't know, people might forget this, but Compaq ended up being the fastest company to hit $100 million in sales. Your first year, I believe, which was your first year of sales, your second year of operations, you sell 53,000 PCs, have sales of $111 million, and you eventually become the quickest firm ever to make the Fortune 500, the quickest firm ever to hit the billion-dollar mark. And this is all based on the fact that, in a lot of ways, your computer, starting with the portable and then going on with like the Desk Pro, they tend to run even better than the IBM machines themselves run. Is that right?
Well, yes, in a couple of ways. First, they have more features. In other words, they have a better display. It'll do both high-resolution characters as well as graphics. And then when we come out with our first desktop, we have higher performance. We have tape backup. There are a lot of things IBM just didn't bother with that we were able to fill in and really make a better product. But to get all the way to those numbers, you know, it sounds easy. We just made a compatible computer and everything worked well. There were a whole lot of other pieces of the puzzle that had to fall into place. And I guess that was part of what made the time so amazing, is at each turn in the road, we were able to make a decision that ended up allowing us to keep going on that high growth path and actually keep our competitors away from us. For example, the distribution channel thing. Anybody starting a company needs to really be careful about distribution. Having the greatest product ever and no way to get it to customers is not going to work. So when we went after the computer dealers, we found that we had a product that filled a need that they were already seeing, and we didn't know that ahead of time. But we discovered it. We sort of discovered it before anybody else, and we got enough inputs from the computer stores, from the dealers, that told us very clearly there was a lot of people already asking for this product. That's why we went back and actually had to make serious changes to our plans. We were going to, if we hadn't discovered that pent-up demand and planned for it and really bet the company on it, we couldn't possibly have responded to the demand that developed as we went through the year. We would have, you know, in a good year, if everything had gone well, we might have been able to get $30 or $40 million in sales. So what we had to do in order to achieve that $111 million was, in the beginning of the year, in the first quarter, go back, take the pent-up demand we had discovered, figure out what the real potential was, and then go rescale it to putting it in capital. We went back to the market for the third time and raised $20 million in March of 1983, just as we were really getting going, in order to fund both that we believed were there for us that year.
And part of the success also is that you have a focus on the user. A key is that you're always bending over backwards to make things backwards compatible. Every time you come out with a new machine, it still works with the old software, it still works with the old peripherals, and even IBM itself didn't seem to take that much care to make sure that happened.
Yeah, that was another one of those things that really surprised us. As you said, we were customer-focused, and how did we get there? It's a common-sense way to think. If you're going to sell products, you might want to meet the needs of the customer. So we were always thinking about, what do they need? How can we do this or that to make it serve their needs better? And one of the obvious things to us was when we brought out the next generation product was to make it run all the old software. After all, running all the software that's already out there was such an obvious advantage of our first product. Making the next product continue to run all that software seemed like the same kind of thing. And here's the twist. As a result of having had to do all that hard work and make our first one run all the software, it was relatively easy to make each next generation run all of the existing software. That was something we had gained without realizing it during that first effort. IBM never had to do that. They just came out with the next generation. In fact, looking back, I realized that the only reason they were as compatible as they were when they went from one to the next was because the microprocessor from Intel was compatible. The rest of the computer, which was also important, had a lot of incompatibilities. And so at each step, each time IBM came out with a new PC, there was more and more software that didn't run. And there, they didn't ever seem to pick up on that, and customers did pick up on the fact that we did. And, you know, strangely led to one of our dealers that sold both IBM and Compaq at one point saying, yeah, Compaq is more compatible with IBM than IBM is, which sounded like gibberish if you didn't understand that we're talking about backward compatibility with the previous generation products.
Well, and talk a little bit about Compaq's relationship with Intel and Microsoft as well, because sort of ad hoc, you guys end up creating sort of an alliance because you're more willing to work with both companies to move computing forward. For example, IBM initially doesn't bring out a 386 machine, but you guys providentially and bravely are willing to take the leap with Intel and launch a 386 machine.
Yes, but we got to that point through building sort of certainly a strong relationship, but mutual respect between us and Intel and also with Microsoft. The reason we did that is going back to this key technology we developed in the beginning, how to make our machine compatible. Neither Microsoft nor Intel really they didn't have to do the same thing, so they didn't have the technology at their fingertips like we did. Obviously, they understood the importance of making each new thing, each new version of DOS. You know, if you had to change your software every time, that was a problem, or each new version of Intel processor. The 286 came along, and IBM comes out with the AT. It doesn't run a lot of the software. It was at that point when we were working with both Microsoft and Intel, they began to understand that we really did have this technology. We knew how to make those things compatible. So as the 386 is being developed, the 286 had quite a few flaws in it. So everybody, you know, you can find Gates and a lot of other people saying at the time, you know, the 286 needs to go fast. We need to get the 386 out. So they're rushing the 386 out, and they're both coming to us to help make sure that both of the DOS that's for it and the chip itself are backward compatible. So we're working with them closely already, but we're also used to IBM being in there and sort of leading the way and pacing things. And it was IBM deciding to go after the PS2, which we didn't know at the time. We knew they were not ready to go after the 386. And they decided they were going to delay the 386. It opened the door for us to slip in front of them. And they, I think, were confident that because of the way the world had always worked, that nobody would successfully be able to get out in front of them. They were the dominant leader, Everybody waited for them to come out with the next generation, especially processor, but any major technology. Again, they didn't understand that this was something totally different. Now that we had an industry standard developing, the key thing, the single most important thing about any new machine was that it run all of the old software. So we knew how to make the 386 chip compatible, working with Intel, how to make DOS compatible, working with Microsoft, and then how to make the whole machine actually run every piece of software that was out there for the older models. And we believe that in doing so, instead of thinking of this as a major new architecture advance, which of course it was on the inside, to a customer, it was a machine that ran all of its current software, but it ran it three times faster than the old one. It was paying for more speed. And at the time, we were in the infancy that there was an insatiable demand for more and more performance. So we believe it was a pretty safe move, although there was no way to know for sure. Just the question mark that it not being from IBM that was there could have been a bigger factor than it was. It turns out it wasn't a big factor. And I guess that was proven because 6 months after we introduced the 386 PC, it takes off like a rocket, so we can't build enough in those first 6 months. Then IBM introduces the PS2, their totally new architecture, totally proprietary, OS2, a new operating system. But it's based on the 286. That's what they had been working on while we were building the 386. Our 386 sales don't slow down at all. They just continue growing rapidly. So that was a sign that we were right, that the market really valued being able to buy new technology and still be able to run all the old software. And that was going to turn out to be a big problem for IBM the next couple of years. In fact, eventually a killer problem for them.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Right. You speak about creating the industry standard, and I feel like sort of history only remembers that it became the Windows and Intel duopoly, but in your book, there's a strong case to be made that Compaq was a real leader and maybe a third leg of that stool in creating what became the industry standard, because you form eventually a coalition that's called the Gang of Nine to solidify the architecture and the industry standard technology. Do you feel like that Compaq maybe has not gotten enough credit for creating what became the industry standard?
Well, you know, we didn't worry about credit. We were getting enough of a reward by the success of the company by doing those things that we didn't worry about who did what. But part of the reason for doing the book was so that, as a minimum, our employees would know what they had actually taken part in, that they actually had a much bigger impact on the world than history generally reported. So, in other words, it wasn't a high priority for us to get the record straight at that point in time. But you're exactly right. The sequence of events that happened along that few-year period, we were really almost the magician in the back room guiding it. We were the company that had the technology to ensure backward compatibility, and that was the key technology to begin to stop IBM's advance with their new PS2. I mean, they sold millions of those. People look back now and say, oh, that was a bad idea. Well, it was viewed as a great idea at the time and was about to succeed because not only did all of the press and analysts believe it, not only did all of their customers believe it, but all of our competitors, all of the other computer companies, were buying licenses from IBM and beginning to build PS2 compatibles. It really looked like the Pied Piper. You know, you look down the path far enough and you see, oh, IBM is so much more in control than they ever were before. They're going to call all the shots. It's going to be an IBM-dominated and controlled ball game. And so we couldn't accept that. But our competitors were just sort of following along and saying, yeah, we're going to beat Compaq and we're going to be the best number two out there. And we just kept after it until we finally found a way that we thought might possibly have enough value to stop IBM from succeeding in taking over the industry. But they were well on their way to doing it before that happened.
One thing I want to cycle back to, because you said in the book no one knew about this, and I certainly didn't know about this. In terms of the relationship with Microsoft and MS-DOS, Microsoft, you guys create a version of DOS that is so good and so compatible that Microsoft ends up licensing your version of DOS back to them?
Yes, and it's one of those strange things that we kept it secret because it seemed like it would just muddy the water for our competitors, for Microsoft. We did it because, as I had mentioned earlier, there were so many changes we had to make to their version of MS-DOS, the one they sent to each company. They sent the same thing to everybody, okay? So they send us standard MS-DOS. We take it and we make hundreds of changes to it. So they come out with a new version of MS-DOS, and now we take that one, and we have to go through it and make hundreds of changes. We don't reverse engineer the changes like we did in the beginning, but there's still a lot of work to be done to go through and make sure we get them all right, and where they've made changes, we have to figure out how that's different and adjust appropriately. So it was a maintenance nightmare, and it was going to get a lot worse. And so there was a lot of interest in, well, let's give this version back to Microsoft and let it become their standard. Now, from Microsoft's standpoint, all of their computer companies that were using MS-DOS wanted a compatible version, and they didn't like going off and making, whatever changes they were making to it to try to be compatible, and they were not succeeding very well. We were recognized widely as by far the most compatible. So we were giving Microsoft something that their customers were asking for. So we were able to license back to them. Microsoft does whatever they do with it and gets it ready to become their standard version of Microsoft and then begins to sell it to all the other computer companies. It sounded like we were giving away the family jewels because since compatibility was one of the key features we had, the most compatibility. But the market was moving so fast, we made a judgment, a trade-off, that we will always be ahead of anybody that gets this from Microsoft and uses it because we're out there on the leading edge. So when a new feature comes to market, we figure out what changes are made. Then later, we send those back to Microsoft. Later, they send it to our competitors. And so we're all out in front. In fact, if you follow our strategy through that whole 10-year period, or probably for the next 10 or 12 years, just being out in front for a few months was all we needed to be able to stay in the lead. That was kind of a different approach. Everybody thinks of intellectual property as building an immovable wall that your competitors can't come in. And that just wasn't the way it worked in an industry standard environment. But if you could get even a few months of lead on your competitors, then you could actually build a differentiation that had a lot of value, and that's what we did. That became our strategy, and we became very good at executing it.
In terms of IBM, when you read not only your history of it, but other histories, It almost seems like their heart was never really in it. Do you think that they just never really got the microcomputer industry or the PC industry in general?
Well, I think that's an accurate statement, and in fact, it can be applied much broader than that. The also not remembered nowadays is that right at that moment in history, in the late 80s, the Japanese were expected to take over every part of the electronics industry. They had already taken over radios, portable radios, TVs, anything electronic. They just applied their ability to manufacture at a low cost and eventually good quality, and would come take over the market. And it was assumed that they were going to take over the PC market. But what happened is it developed along different lines than the computer market of the past or any electronics industry of the past. When this industry standard began to develop, it threw a twist into it that nobody really got for a long time. And fortunately for Compaq, we got it because we were at the heart of it being created. It was clearly in our best business interest to be able to have access to all this software and then to be able to deliver backward compatibility with each new product. It made it easier for customers to upgrade. And so we were driving it rather than trying to figure out what was going on around us. And IBM never got that part of it. They didn't. The Japanese didn't. That's why all of the many companies that were trying at the time to get in, Epson and, Fujitsu had come out with any. And then there were Taiwanese companies, a number of different ones. Some of them are still around, but they were slow to pick up on this unique thing about the industry standard. IBM could have clearly, I think, certainly in my mind, still be the personal computer leader if they had understood what was going on with this industry standard. But they just viewed it as it's just another computer market, and it was going to end up working out the same way, and they missed how important the change was.
So coming up on June 1st, there's this new AMC show called Halt and Catch Fire, and it seems to be really loosely based on this sort of story. It takes place in Texas. They decide that they want to clone in an IBM computer. They have to reverse engineer the BIOS. The IBM lawyers come in and threaten them and things like that. Have you seen the first episode that's been previewed online?
I have not looked at the whole episode. I've seen the trailer for it, and I am going to watch it because it looks pretty exciting.
Well,
it may actually be as exciting as the real thing.
Well, I can tell you the very first scene first segment, I suppose, has a gratuitous and kind of gritty sex scene when they're trying to recruit a new programmer. So I don't know. I doubt that that's how recruiting went down, but I guess that's the artistic license. I that does make me think, though, they're accurate in terms of setting it in Texas, and a lot of people don't remember this also, but in the 80s there's sort of a Silicon Prairie that's there. I mean, there's Texas Instruments and Compaq and Radio Shack and Dell is in Texas. Was there something? What was going on in Texas that for a long time there, that's a hub of technology innovation?
A lot of people have asked that question, and it's hard to put your finger on it. I'll take it a step further even and say that it dawned on me one day back in the late 80s that by that time, of the five companies that had at one time been in the top two or three PC companies, of the top five, three had been from Texas. Apple was from the West Coast, IBM from the East Coast, but the first one had been Tandy. They were a leader, if not the leader, for a while before IBM came along. And then Compaq came along and got into the industry standard arena first. And then Dell came along behind us and, using the foundation that we had built, came up with an interesting twist, which was actually Dell had two twists. One was the direct model, And the other was being able to deliver good customer service online, or actually at the time over the phone, that people just didn't think was possible. But Dell solved two key issues and carved out a niche for themselves.
And Compaq, it was really one of the biggest tech success stories of the 80s. Like we said, you know, first to Fortune 500, or fastest to Fortune 500 and fastest to a billion in sales. What do you attribute? I mean, obviously, you said that your key innovation was this insight into the industry standard, serving the users the best. But what else was the key insight that led to Compaq's success, in your opinion?
You know, there are a number of factors. I look back, and one of the things that struck me when I sort of looked at the story that I'd written was that, gee, we took a lot of risk. And you know, you had to take big risks if you make a difference. And I think there was something about Texas, you know, from the water and the oil field to raising cattle out on the range. There's a certain risk-taking gene almost that runs through a lot of Texans. It certainly looks like it when you look around down here, what's going on now. So I think that helped us. We certainly we took the risks. We didn't take them wildly. We carefully analyzed and tried to make the best decision possible. In many cases, we saw safe decisions where other people saw only risk, but that was because we were much closer to what was going on, and we were also very open to doing things differently. I guess there was part of the personality issues was almost if the industry said X, you know, be very careful. Make sure there's not a better path. And there were three or four times through the 80s that we did just that, and when we got through analyzing it, we realized there was a different path that was better. And we took it, and each one of those helped us along.
Well, the book that we keep referring to that Rod has written is called Open: How Compaq Ended IBM's PC Domination and Helped Invent Modern Computing. And, you know, aside from, if you want a great story of a crazy startup that takes a lot of risk, there's also really, really great insights and stories about you know, seemingly mundane things like managing manufacturing and inventory, and there's a lot of times when you're running on a razor's edge in terms of you know, if you don't produce enough, you might lose the customers, but if you produce too much, you're going to go into bankruptcy. I highly recommend this book for a really well-rounded story of what it takes to create a successful startup.
And I will add to that, hopefully it's a thriller of a sort, even though it's a real business story. It as I look back at it, it reminded me of some sort of Indiana Jones type thriller where at the end of each chapter, you're about to die, you know, and you got to read the next chapter to find out how you survived that one. Because there were that many life-threatening challenges that came along throughout the 80s for us.
Well, Rod Canyon, thank you for taking the time to talk to us about it.
Thank you for allowing me to do so. I'm excited to be able to tell our story, and I think it seems to be received well by those who have heard it. Thank you very much.